Welcome to Headlines. This is David Lichtenstein. We have a fantastic show tonight. Unfortunately, Reb Chaim Cohn was not able to make it, but we have three really fantastic dayanim. We have Reb Daniel Neustadt. He's the Yoshev Reish of the Vad HaRabbanim of Detroit. He's the Reish Bezdin of the city of Detroit. We have from Yerushalayim, Reb Yosef Greenwald, who's on the Bezdin of Givat Zev, and he was formerly on the Beis Havad. And then we have from Lakewood, a brilliant young dayan, Reb Daniel Dumbruff, a dayan in the Beis Havad of Lakewood. And here are some of the exciting questions we're going to be discussing. What would you say? You want to hire a headhunter. Could they hire somebody away from, you know, from a person's firm? Is there an issa? Is it Anim HaPachara? Can you hire people away? A party planner, an accountant, whatever the case may be. Can you grab somebody else's? You know, people, they buy stuff from Land's End or Nordstrom, and at the end of the season, they trade them in because these big stores have a very liberal policy, and they do this on a repeated basis. Is it mutter? Is it not mutter? Somebody's going for a mortgage. Can they get a mortgage from Quicken Loans, which is owned by Yid? Alternatively, if they're borrowing it from a friend, the mortgage, and their in-laws or parents co-sign on the mortgage, do they need a heter iska for them as well? We have like 7 or 8 extremely exciting questions, and we're going to have a really fantastic show tonight. You can listen to us on WMCA 570 AM or WMCA.com or on the Zev Brenner Network, either both Matzah Shabbos tonight at 11 or Monday morning at 11. Additionally, you can get us on a podcast at Headlines Books Podcast. You can send all your questions into info@headlinesbook.com. You know, I'd like to start out each week with some type of a thought. And these are the weeks of Balak and Bilam and Pinchas, who killed Bilam. So here's something interesting, and I think it's really important. Bilam was the great curser, right? He knew how to curse. Boy, he could zarain curses that lasted forever. What was his strength? He was an ayin ra. He had a bad eye, the evil eye. So the Gemara says that it says, Kael Zayim B'chol Yayim. The Rabbeinu Shalom gets mad every single day. For how long? A thousandth of a second. And it says that Bilam was able to exactly, you know, align, you know, conjure that moment. And at that moment, when Hashem, when God was mad, he would find it and boom, he would lay his curse on. So that's something interesting. Somebody who has the ability to curse, somebody with a bad eye, you know what it means? They can find that teeny second of the day. It's like a grain of sand. And boy, they turn that grain of sand into the center of everything. They build it and grow on it, and they make this thousandth of a second into the mainstay of the day. Alternatively, it says, "Des gimel mi talmidei Bilam." And juxtaposed neged Talmidei Bilam, the Mishnah says, is Talmidei Avram. Avram is famous. Avram is Veheyei Bracha. Avram was the source of blessing in the world. So if the ability to curse is to find that bad second in the day and just get fixed on it and dwell on it and make it the center, become, you know, just the center of you, fixated on it, what is Veheyei Bracha? Looking at that one sparkling moment in the day, in your life, in my life, or alternatively, in another person. What is something beautiful that that person has, and let's talk about that gift and build on it. Cursing, finding that grain of the blessing. You want to have the eye of Avraham Avinu. Let's look at the other person and find the beautiful thing. Let me share a story with you. Do you know that two great friends, two fabulous figures in Jewish history, was the Baal HaTanya, right? He was a Talmud of both the Magid and post the Magid, right? And Reb Levi Yitzchak Abadichev, they were good friends. So one time the Baal HaTanya was in Abadichev, And he was telling him, he said, you know, I have a terrible case, really an urgent need for tzedakah. There's a family, they were thrown into a dungeon by the local pirates because they couldn't pay their taxes. You know what it's like living in a dungeon in Poland, circa 1750? Terrible. Worse than an LL flight. So he said, in economy. So he said, we have to do whatever we can to get these people out of there. So is there anybody wealthy who can come up with the 1,000 rubles we need? So Rabbi Levi Yitzchak thought, he said, I'm sorry, this is a very poor town, but there's one guy, he's such a miser, he's the stingiest, cold-hearted person, comes to shul and everything, but he's so tight-fisted, not a penny. So the Balatanya said, you know what, let's go to that person. But he said to the Baditcheva, who was very emotional, he said, but I want to go alone. Baditcheva said, no, I must see how you do this. He said, you can come with me, told the holy Baditcheva, you can come with me on one condition. You don't open your mouth or say a peep, not a peep. So Baditcheva said, okay. So they go up this guy's big house, up the gates, they open the gates, they knock on the door. And who's there? I hope it's not collectors again. Well, he says, it's Levi Yitzchak, the Rav of the city. He says, oh, Rabbi, he opens the door. And he comes in, and the Baal Tanya says, listen, I have to tell you a very sad story. There's this family that was thrown in a dungeon, 3 children and parents. It's the winter. They're shivering. And this guy takes out a handkerchief, and he starts wiping his eyes, and he blows his nose. He says, I'm just so moved by this. It moves me to the depths of my soul. He says, we need 1,000 ruble. So the guy goes, okay. And after crying, he goes into the next door. They hear a safe creaking. The door opens. The guy comes out 2 minutes later, and he says, here. And he gives the Baal HaTanya 1 ruble. One. So Levi Yitzchak is about to go crazy. This mechutzif, we need 1,000. After seeing 2 G'dayli Ador come, he gives him. And the Baal HaTanya gives him a look. Remember, you promised. He's okay. Baal Tanya takes his hand. He says, listen, I have to bless you. You have no idea what a mitzvah this is. 1 ruble, 1 step closer. You should be blessed. Hashem should open your heart. You should be so big. Thank you so much. They walk out the door. They're like 5 steps out the door. And as the door opens again, the miser comes running back out. He says, wait, come back in, come back in. He says, tell it to me again. He says, you know, this is a terrible story. This can't. That's such a beautiful family. He goes back, and he comes back with a 5 ruble note. Again, the Baditcheva's going crazy. They're already 2 hours into this. The story, the Baal Tanya gives him a look. Thank you. You should be. He fuses him. He thanks him. He hugs him. They walk out. Now they're a half a block later. This miser comes running out. He says, you know, I thought about it very much. It moves me. Come back. They come back. He goes back. He says, here's 20 ruble. By now, the Baditcheva is about to explode. That they have 26 rubles. They've been at this all morning. Baal Tanya looks at him, not a word. Okay. They go out again. He comes running. At the end, it's 100 ruble. He gives 500 ruble. He gives the whole 1,000. So the Baditcheva says, he says, how? He says, I saw the grain. I believed in that grain of beauty, that one tiny, a grain of sand in the person, and I built it. And in the end, look what he did. He did the entire Hatzalah. Every person, everyone, has that grain of beauty, even myself and you. So if this was the kayach of Bilam. Bilam was able to take the kernel of ugliness that we each have and build on it. Avram took that kernel of beautiness. And the Talmidei Avram exploit that, and they build on it. Avram is es hanefesh ha-sha'asa b'charen. He made tens of thousands, Ram writes. He believed in that kernel of beauty of humanity. The Talmidei Bilam HaRasha, they exploit it. They're able to find that ugliness in each of us and just talk about it and build upon it. So these are the parashas of Bilam. So wouldn't it be a fantastic Kabbalah for each of us to make and to say, you know, 3 times a day we daven, maybe once morning, once in the afternoon, once in the night, try to see something beautiful in our spouse, in our child, just that little kernel, or even in myself, so that I and you can both be Talmidei Avraham Avinu, learn to exploit and water and create fertile soil for that beautiful peace in each one of us. And even Chazal say, in Pischuli Kepischei Shalmaka, find the eye of the needle, so tiny, my age, with I need to put on reading glasses to find it, that tiny, but with Kepischei Shalulam, it can open up like the gates of Yankee Stadium. That's the limit. Let's go to our fabulous guests. We're going to start with Rabbi Neustadt. Thank you for listening. We have the honor of having with us on the phone Harav HaGoyin, Reb Daniel Neustadt. He's the Rosh Beis Din of Detroit, and he's also the Yoshev Rosh of the Vad HaRabbonim of the esteemed city of Detroit. Welcome, Rav Neustadt.
Hello, how are you, Baruch Hashem?
So, we're doing a Chosha Mishpat show today, and we'd like to put forth a number of questions. So, there are many stores, many even national stores, and I'm not an expert, like somebody told me, like Land End or Nordstrom, where they have a return forever policy. That means you can actually, and I do it, I guess, they for client satisfaction. So some people go ahead and they buy their entire, you know, all their children's clothing, and the children rip them and this and that. And at the end of the season, they just send them back and they say, we'd like a refund. And these big national chains don't ask a question and they send the money back. Well, is there anything halachically wrong that? It feels wrong, but is it halachically wrong?
So in the case that you're describing, the people, let's say somebody bought a pair of pants, and he used it for the season, and then it tore, and then they want to return it, and the store accepts that kind of a return, whether or not it's permitted to go. I think that in the case that you just described, that actually might be mutter. Because they can clearly see, I mean, you bought this pair of pants from the beginning of the season. And you're coming to them 3, 4, 5 months later and saying, look, it's torn. If they have a policy that they accept anything that tears, no questions asked, and they don't care about the circumstances, and they don't do anything, they just accept it, you'll have to take advantage of that. In other words, you didn't buy the item initially in order to return it. That's not really what happened. You bought it in order to use it, and it tore, and they, for some business reason of theirs, have a policy that they take back anything that tears. I see no reason why you can't take advantage of that. I don't see any problem with that.
Let me advance the question. Now okay. You have a person, he has a very simple idea. He's going to buy all his clothes from these stores. He's, you know, his kids are growing, so when they're 3 years old or 4 years old, buy the clothing. They send them back at the end of the season. They buy the 4-year-old clothing. So with one purchase, they could take their kids from ages 3 till 23. And the store has a policy, we take back clothing. Is there anything wrong with that?
If the store has such a policy, and you're not, in no way are you lying to them or anything, you say, look, I bought this, I used it, I want to return it, what is your policy? If the store says, yes, we will accept it, I see nothing wrong with that. The only way I see something wrong is if someone goes into a store to buy, knowing that he's going to use it once or twice, let's say they have a chasana, or let's say they're going on a trip, and they need a GPS, okay? And they say, okay, I'm going to buy the GPS, I'm clearly going to return it when the trip is over. I'm only buying it because I have a 24-hour trip and I'm going to return it when the trip is over. That is different.
Why would that be different than the case I told you, the second case?
No. Then you're clearly going in there in order to return it. In other words, in the case that you said, it's clearly, you're saying to the company, I used this for 6 months. I've had my usage of it. It's not like I didn't use it. But if you take it back, I'll take it back. That's one thing.
But I'm doing it initially. I know that when my kid grows to the next size, I'm just sending that back. So I'm buying it with the intent of returning it when he grows to the next size. Would that be usa?
No, I don't think it's Elsa. No, I don't think it's Elsa. But I don't think it's such a I don't know. Stores have such a policy that they let you use something for 6 months and then bring it back? I don't know.
Well, I'm the wrong guy to ask, but I've been told that.
Yeah, me too.
But you know, it's interesting. I spoke to somebody on Wall Street, actually, from a guy who works on Wall Street, and he said to me, his reaction was, he says, are you telling me that companies like Lands' End and Nordstrom don't understand their consumers? He says, if they made that policy, they understand their consumer, there's a reason why they do it, and that's it.
Right.
He was very much in concordance with what you said.
Right. I agree. If the store is aware of what's going on and that's their policy, listen, their policy is based on the fact that many people are going to keep it, they're not going to return it, people forget to return it. There are all kinds of marketing ideas that they know better than us. So, yeah, I think it's okay to take advantage of that. There's no gnaver involved. The only gnaver that I see is if a store clearly is against that policy. And they say, no, if you used it then and it works, we don't take it back. But and you're taking advantage of that and saying, oh, well, I bought it, I changed my mind, whatever. That you can't do, lechatchila, to go in there in order to return it. That costs the company money. Restocking fee, labor, packaging, you're causing them a loss. That would be different. There's a thin line there. You really have to know the exact company policy. What exactly are they saying? If they're saying, we don't care that you come in and you buy and you return, we have no problems with that, okay.
So if they say it and they just created an awkward policy themselves that you're following, that's fine. However, if you're fooling them, in other words, if they knew that would not be their intent, then it would be problematic.
Right. That would be Gnevus Das at the least. And Gnevus Das is also from a Yid, from a Goy, no difference. It may be Gnevus Mammon too, but it's certainly Gnevus Das. And that's
right.
Certainly
awesome. So if, let's say somebody would buy something on their credit card to build up miles and then return the item, but they were able to keep their miles and they never had the intent to buy it, that would be problematic because that would not have been the intent of the company.
Of course.
Let me ask you another question that's quite relevant to people who run businesses. We all know, I mean, if you're in business, you know, there's something called headhunters. A headhunter is a job that we use headhunters all the time. We say, hi, we're looking for somebody to run our accounting department. We need somebody, and we do a job profile. We would like somebody who has 10 years experience. They've had, you know, with either, you know, depending on your business, they've had public company experience. They have, you know, rating agency experience. You give them a whole thing. So the headhunter looks. So what do? They use LinkedIn for the most part, and they start looking for people with that profile. And usually they look for somebody who's hired because nobody wants to hire somebody who doesn't have a job, right?
Yeah.
And what would they do? They would call up 10 people or 8 people who file sits and say, look, you know, whatever you're making, we think you'll be better off over here for these reasons. This guy really needs you, his company's growing, etc. How about we meet and let me look at your profile, let me look at your resume, and let me give you a proposal. It happens every day in America. Well, a guy calls up, he says, look, I need, he hires the headhunter. Usually they take a third up front, a third 30 or 60 days later, and a third upon completion. And he says, I have great news for you. You know, you're looking for an accountant. Yossel has a guy. She's fantastic. She's been there 11 years already. She's learned everything. She's being way underpaid compared to where she is. She has a CPA and a master's. I'm going to make the call. And she's, you know, you'll offer her 25% more. And bingo, your whole accounting department is in business. Am I allowed to do that or not?
So you're talking about where the headhunter will be a frum Jew. In other words, the question will come from a headhunter. He's a frum person.
Or it could be from me. I'm the business owner hiring. He's
okay,
my shliach.
Okay.
And I'm hiring this person away from Yossel. The headhunter is just the shliach, the monkey in the middle.
Right. And you're hiring him, and you're hiring the accountant away from another yid, another frum person. And that's the question, if you're allowed to move him away. Yeah.
Yes.
So this goes into some very heavy duty shilas of.
Respectfully, Rabbi Neustadt, we're talking to a very heavy duty Rav.
I hear. But the Rishonim discussed this issue. There's a case in the Rishonim, it's called Ma'arufia. It's actually probably an Arabic word. Nobody exactly knows 100% the origin of it. And that refers to a situation where two people have a close business relationship. In other words, I'm a customer of yours or I'm an employer of yours. We have a relationship where we do business together. And a third person, an outside person, wants to come and get that account or get that employee, whatever the case may be. The Rashba, who is really the first source that discusses this, the Rashba discusses a case where you have a pirate or a king in this country or a minister who had a Jewish tailor. He had the account of a Jewish tailor who sold all his clothing. And another Jewish tailor wanted to come and solicit the account away from the original Jewish tailor. So the question was, is he allowed to go do that? Is he allowed to go basically go after that account, knowing that the original Jew already has a relationship and he's the tailor for that particular person? And the Rashba says that you can't do that. He calls that ma'arufia. He says when there's a close business relationship taking place between two people and they have a smichas das, they have an assumption, a well-founded assumption that I have a job by you, I'm your customer, I have your account, we have this relationship. Somebody else may not come and disturb that relationship, that close relationship that exists between the two parties is a smichas das, and therefore you are now coming and disturbing that. He bases it in a number of sources. He compares it to makira kahuna, where a person gives his truma to a certain kayin, and therefore it's like assumed that he will always be giving his truma nicer to a certain kayin, and another kayin may not come and ask for it, even though there's no actual contract between them, but there's an assumption that I will generally give my truma to him. So over here also, there's an assumption that I get my business, or that he works for me, or in any kind of a relationship like that. And the Rashba says that one is not allowed to do so based on this halacha of ma'arufia. He says if it's done, Bezdin cannot take it away. It's not like Bezdin could force him to relinquish it, but you're not allowed to do it. Somebody does that, it's considered a rasha. Now, the Ramah quotes this Rashba, and he says that in some communities, the Nayig din ma'arufia, they actually conduct themselves like that, and they tell people that you cannot get involved in such a business relationship to disturb it, where in other communities, they do not. In other words, depending on the customs of the various communities, whether or not they're Nayig, the din of ma'arufia. And because they say, what do you mean? It's a free market. I could go here. I could go there. You don't own me. Why am I forever indebted to you just because you assume that we have a relationship? So you can argue this both ways. And the halacha l'maaseh, it really depends on the minig hamedinas, the Rambam says. It depends how we conduct ourselves. And later, Achrayim talk about it. There is a Chasam Sefer, there's a Mechas Yitzchak. And they basically agree that we are naig. We do assume that people who have a strong business relationship, we prohibit and we discourage that kind of a competition. We don't allow people to take away employees from one another. However, if it's done, we can't invalidate it, because halachically we can't actually do it. But but there's an important, so that is already in the Ramah. But there's a very important issue that really qualifies this halacha. And that is like this. If we would live in a close society where Beis Din is in control, from Jews are, you know, everything is conducted al pi halacha. So then we could say, look, you have no right al pi halacha to go ahead and try to solicit this employee or this account or whatever the case may be. Because we are enforcing, that's ma'arufia, this is our minig, this is what we do, and we have a right to enforce that. When we live in an open society where others do not follow the halacha, such as non-observant people or goyim, who are going to be headhunting, and therefore, I don't have to be at a disadvantage because I'm a halachic Jew. Just because I keep halacha doesn't mean I have to lose out. If everybody, it would be an equal playing field, and we all will adhere to the halacha, so then yeah, you got to follow. But if I don't headhunt this guy, and another headhunter will find him, so I lose my commission, you have to do that. Does that make sense clear?
Yes, I would like to. Is this chiddush brought? I mean, it's a beautiful chiddush. Is this something you're saying, or are you?
The price can say so, and the Pesachash and others say so, that this only applies in equal playing field.
Closed society. So let me ask you a question about, to me, because it's. They're not discussing the concept of Ani Amahapach B'Chararia, because the shail of it happens by Schiris, am I correct?
Right, this is not exactly, this is a little different than Ani Amahapach B'Chararia. Yeah. They're closely related to Sugyas, but they're not exact same.
Because the Nesivos HaMishpat says that you don't have it by in Reish Lamed Zayin. So let me ask you. Let me ask you, though, a question.
Try something. This Halach of Marufya doesn't always apply. It's only when there's an existing business relationship which is assumed to last forever, so to speak. It's there, and nothing is going to get in the way.
Well,
in today's business climate, it's not like that. You're right. People constantly are jumping jobs in order to improve their pay grade and their scale and their health benefits. You're right. And Marufia, it doesn't always apply. It's only in a situation where there is a close, assumed relationship between the parties. In your case, or in many cases, where people don't have such loyalty to their employers anymore. I mean, employers don't have loyalty, employees don't have loyalty. It's a different world today. And therefore, if people do have money, that's considered already higher. And once you're in that level, you no longer have to patronize the Yehudi.
Well, Rav Neustadt, thank you very much. Every time you're on the program, enlightening. It's hearing the just beautiful divrei Elokim. Chaim, thank you very much. We hope to have you on again in the future.
Thank you very much, and be mitzvah.
We have the honor of having with us on the phone from Lakewood, New Jersey, Dayan Daniel Dombrov, who's a Dayan in the Beis Havad Lakewood. Welcome, Rav Dombrov.
Thank you.
So I'd like to ask you a few questions that are common questions, but, you know, people don't know Chayshin Mishpat very well. It's quite complicated. So here's a question that many people struggle with. Nobody knows the flaws of a product as much as a seller. How transparent should a seller be? You know, there's a story, Rabbi Elia Lapian, they say, over, had bought an Esrig Pardis once. Mm-hmm. And he realized afterwards that he wasn't such a good farmer. So he tried to he said he wants to sell it. So they kept bringing him buyers, and he would take the buyer out, and he would say, "Listen, you know, I have to tell you that this tree over here last year didn't have such good fruit. This one, the tractor ran over the roots. We have no idea what type of damage." And he said to the buyer, "And by the way, you know, you look a little old and straggly. I'm not even sure you're up to taking care of this. Honestly," he said, "I think it's Geneva to sell it to you." And they brought him buyer after buyer, and each person, he was so bending over, honest, and he would ask about the buyer's health, if he could take care of it. He actually took him years and years and years until finally they sold the Cardis when he was out of town. So, but we know that there are halachas of Geneva, as real Geneva. So give us, if somebody selling a product, how transparent do we have to be about the flaws?
Okay, it's an excellent question. Before I begin, I just would like to give a disclaimer for speaking to such a large audience. Obviously, it's difficult to really give an answer that will address every situation, and therefore, I'm going to give an answer that I believe will be a general understanding to the public about the question asked without actually committing to anything halacha l'maisa.
Our goal is to educate, and if it comes l'maisa, go ask your local Rav.
Okay, perfect.
Yeah.
Okay, so I think there's really three issues that we have to address, and we'll do them one by one. There's the issue of mekatos, that if there is actually a flaw, a mum, that could invalidate the sale. That wasn't the intention of the buyer. That's issue number one. Number two is the issue, like you mentioned, of Gnevas Das, which is actually applicable even to non-Jews. There is an issue of Gnevas Das. And the third issue is the issue of Aynah, that very possibly the price will not will not be correct for this item if it does have these flaws, then the price might be off. Let's go through them one by one.
So, Rabbi Dabra, let me give you three cases. How's that?
Okay.
I think most people understand that if you're selling a washing machine and it doesn't work, you know, everybody understands there's something wrong with that. I would modify the case. You have two washing machines. You have the General Electric and, I don't know, the Frigidaire. And the feedback is that the General Electric is not such a good product. It's worse than the Frigidaire. But you make more money on the GE. But it works, just, you know, from different customers. Do I have to say that or no?
Mm-hmm. So, in other words, you're saying there's no actual mum in the product.
Yeah, because I think most of our audience would agree that if there's a mum in the product, it would seem that it's dishonest, it's Geneva's Das, it's maybe Geneva, it's maybe Mekartais. I'm saying something that is a little more subtle, like, you know, you happen to know this is a better product, or you happen to know that, you know, this one will last 2 years longer, or in colored clothing it does a better job. Like, and but I make an extra $50 on the GE if I sell it, and less on the Frigidaire, the price the same. Like, into how much detail do I have to go? You know, there's a rule, like, basically that's the question.
Okay. Okay, I mean, obviously that changes the whole face of the question. Then already we're not dealing with this. It's an issue of simply giving advice. It's more giving advice to the buyer as far as what's the best product. Maybe there's maybe a little bit of lifnei iver, if you sort of encourage one over the other. It's hard to say that there would be any geneva's das unless you're encouraged. I mean, if you go ahead and encourage the model that doesn't function as well, so then. And then you give an impression that that's the better model. So that, you know, I think then we would be running into the issue of Geneva's Das. Otherwise, you know, you're not, I don't know if you're, barring Lifnei Iver, so maybe Lifnei Iver will be an issue, but barring that, you're not there to give advice. You're there to sell it and it's be their job to get the advice. Again, that's Maker Adin. I'm not, obviously, the story of Rebellion of Lan is definitely commendable, and it's for B'nai Aliyah, it's definitely something to strive for. But if you want to know, if we're talking halacha over here, then offhand, it's hard to see anything other than, like what I mentioned before, as being an obligation in halacha.
So,
if we talk halacha, it says very clearly, if something has a mum, obviously, if this car is going to have a problem, within the week, there's obviously something, there's some sort of serious flaw, which would be a mum. And how are we going to contend with that issue? Number two, there may be a Geneva's Das issue, like I said. And number three, the price is obviously off for this product. So nonetheless, you're bringing up the point that it's buyer beware. So it would seem that there's an understanding that all that is on the buyer and he's agreeing to the terms that he has no recourse should there be a problem with this product.
And let me interrupt.
Yeah.
Let me give some teeth to this argument. I'm going to quote a Chafetz Chaim in the end of Hilchos Ruchilus. He says, if a person knows at a chassin that he's not a chacham b'tayra, you're not allowed to tell them a chutin. The lashon of the Chafetz Chaim is, d'ihu d'afse d'anafshe, d'hayaloi l'haylichai etzal balei tayra, sheyenasu es koyach achmasei v'yediyasei. You were careless.
Mm-hmm.
You should have done your due diligence. That's the Chafetz Chaim at the end of Hilchos Ruchilus Sira Sheni Yisvav, which would lead one to believe that caveat emptor is not just, you know, English law, but it would seem to have some standing in halacha as well.
Right. Now, there is a difference in the sense that over there, we're not dealing with necessarily a tangible mum. I mean, obviously, someone not being versed in Torah is it's a chasaron, obviously, but it's a tangible mum to undo a contractual obligation or a marriage is a whole different story. So I don't know if that's a comparable to the case of the car, which had a tangible mum. So in the case of a tangible mum, there we're going to have some sort of real mechila in place because you do have a schus to get a proper product, and you need a mechila to somehow get rid of that claim. So I do believe that there's a way to go forward with this question. And there's a big machlokus in the Paiskim whether or not when you want to forgo all Mumin, which is basically what you're suggesting, that I have no claim on any flaw in my product, and whatever is wrong with it, I accept. Does that work? Or do you have to specify it? Has this problem, I accept. This problem, I accept. And in halacha, it would seem pretty clearly that that's not good enough to give a general. Mechila would have to be specific. However, nonetheless, it's the place can bring down the Tzitzchik Tshuva and others, the Marsham, that say that there's a minhug of as-is, like, which is basically what you're describing. To buy something as-is is a minhug that is acceptable, and I believe it leads us into a very, very interesting machlokis, a very fundamental machlokis Rishonim, in the idea of how you could forgo a right that the Torah gives you. For example, in this case, to claim that you were offended by the mum, and the other person says, no, you forgo it. So there's we know there's a well-known machlokis as if matzah ma'amasha kasa v'teira applies to monetary schusim, right? Machlokis tanoim. However, there's a machlokis Rishonim within the opinion that says it does work. Does it have to work on the specific, or can I give up my entire right to that schus that Torah gave me? For example, the Torah gives me a right not to be offended in a sale, leisainu, and can I give up that right completely and sort of make a new prescription for how a sale should exist different than the Torah prescribes it? So this, on this point, we have a Rajba that says that that cannot be done. The Torah doesn't allow you to make your own type of sale. All you can do is just address the actual problem. And the Ramban in Yesh Lechlin says that one could actually, since it was given for your benefit, it was given for the buyer's benefit, he could forego it and that would work. So although it looks like the halacha should be that, like the Rajba, based on the Paiskim, however, the terminology here is a very interesting term. It says, Lashon of minhag mevatel halacha, which I believe is addressing this issue, that this minhag of as is can actually be mevatel halacha and tell us that through a minhag one could actually forego his whole right to claiming a mum and basically fall into the framework of the Ramban, and I'm letting go of all my claims here, and that would be effective halacha. However, one last point. In conclusion, which is that I think the Geneva Stas issue is still a serious issue, that if the seller really knew that there was a problem over here and he understood that it's not getting across to the buyer and he's giving over an impression that there's nothing wrong and he's doing a good job at it, then I think that's an issue of Geneva Stas. And I'm not certain about this, but I have a strong possibility that when there's Gnevis Das, that type of minhag would be called a minhag garua, a bad minhag, which would not be respected as a minhag and may undermine then the validity of the sale.
So in conclusion, you're saying, halacha, do we pass in like the Rajba, the Ramban? Like, could you be simich on minhag mevatel halacha? And if I assume you're saying that yes, but however, there would be an issue with Geneva's Das. Is that a fair recapture?
Yes.
Okay, so let me ask you a question. And can I go to another question, which is very relevant, because a lot of people have, let's say, parents co-sign on loans.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a question that is very, hotly disputed now. If a parent co-signs a loan, or if that matter, if any arev, any co-signer signs on a loan, and the actual borrower did a heter iska with the lender, right, does the co-signer have to also sign a heter iska with the lender? Because ultimately, they may end up being the payee.
Right, right. Okay, that's an excellent question. So, actually, bringing up the topic of ribbis, if I could digress for a moment, there's just a message I want to give to listeners out there of a mikshel, which I think is relevant, not directly relevant to your specific case, but there's a one of the biggest mortgage broke bankers today is Quicken Loans, and it's actually Jewish owned. So, and anyone who's thinking of getting involved, we've had already quite a few cases of people that are deep into their loan, and then they realize that there's an issue over here, and it's a very difficult process to fix it at that point. So we just want to make the audience aware that they that it would definitely be necessary to get a heter iskov for that particular company. That
but,
being
I mean,
said,
will Quicken Loans give a heter iskov? Do they even have such a form?
So I don't want to comment on that. I think definitely everyone to do their own research. Your question as far as the co-signer having to be part of the heter iskov. So the question has a technical side to it, and we'll deal with it in a moment. I want to just, if I could give a backdrop here, as getting into Ribbis. So it will be relevant, I think, for the end of our discussion. But as on a more general level, Ribbis is actually brought down, I believe it's in the Tshuvas Marik, that actually refers to it as the most chomer issa in the Torah, in the sense it's the one issa that we find that a person loses his tzchias ha-mason for.
Let me interject with a brief anecdote. They say by Rabbi Yonis and Eibschitz, there was a malva beribis, somebody who used to lend that, you know, real loan shark, and he used to be very hurtful to the community in Hamburg. So when they came to bury him, he was hated by the entire community. So the Chevra Kedisha asked an exorbitant amount. So his family running to the governor of Hamburg, or the mayor, and they said that they're taking, that they're discriminating against me. So they called Rabbi Yonis and Eibschitz, he was the Rav, and he said, no, actually we're giving him a fair price. He said, most people only lease their keva for a limited amount of time till Tchias HaMesim. But he says, somebody who lends at Ribbis, he's not come with Tchias HaMesim, so he's not getting a lease. He's getting a fee simple. He's actually having to buy the plot, and for that we have a different level of pricing.
Wow, very good.
So continue with this anecdote. Continue your halacha.
So actually, to mention a more recent story, there's a fascinating Ramban, Halatarian, I think it's in Parashas Mishpatim, the first place to find Ribbis, where the Ramban throws a parallel. It says, Lefila kenoi shaltichach meter neshech. There's a juxtaposition between being a noisha, being oppressive to the borrower, and taking money from the borrower. The Ramban says the connection is that when a person lends someone money, the relationship shouldn't change, shouldn't take from him covet or money. So I understood from that Ramban, the idea is that the perception of the next person should be shouldn't be such a financial perception. In other words, the person shouldn't see the other person's worth solely financially. And when the person falls into that state where it's solely a financial perception, that's already a very finite way of looking at things, and that's a disconnect from Tchias HaMeisim, which is obviously seeing a person as a neshama, and that would, and in that sense, there would be no place for Ribbis. In other words, obviously he's using your money, but the Ramban says it's based on Eved Loiva Lish Malve, that the root of it is that I view him as an Eved Loiva slave. And as a slave, I could extort him. It's not just like a car where I take rental. It's a way of using the person. He needs me. He needs my money. I'm going to use it to extort money from him, extort cover from him. And that Evelivish Malv is what we're unhappy about, and is sort of a misrepresentation of what a person really is.
Daniel, we're going to run out of time. If you had to ask, if I was a younger man and I came to you and I said, we're borrowing money from a fellow in town. He's giving us a good deal. He wants my in-laws to sign on the loan. Do they need a heter iskov or not? What would you paskin?
I would say I'll just tell you the tutzad heter here. The tutzad heter would be there's a shari day who brings some atashbates that since you're paying the ribbis, even though there's a co-signer, and the co-signer in halacha could be viewed as the one who borrowed the money and relent it to you. There's two examples of Ariv brought in Halacha, but the idea of an Ariv is viewed as someone who borrowed the money and relent it to the borrower, and that sense would need a heteriska. Nonetheless, he has a heter that since you're paying it for your own good to avoid your own issues with the bank, that would not be construed as ribis. However, Halacha, you know, this is a he himself has issues with this heter, the Sharidea. He offers a different option, but I definitely think it would be appropriate to get a heter iska. In your specific case that you gave, where there was a need for a heter iska with the lender, meaning you assumed that the lender was Jewish, in that case it gets a little bit more complicated to be able to make a heter iska, and it would be a more difficult job to actually draw up such a heter iska.
Well, thank you very much. That was Dayan Reb Daniel Dumbruff, Dayan in Lakewood, well-known Dayan in Lakewood. Thank you very much for your time.
My pleasure.
Kolta. We have on the phone with us from Eretz Yisrael, Rav Greenwald. He used to be in the a Dayan on the Beis Havad in Lakewood, and he is now Koil Imke Mishpat, which is a Chayshim Mishpat Koil in Yerushalayim. And he's also on the Beis Din in Givat Zev. Welcome, Rav Greenwald.
Shalom Aleichem.
So here is a question that a number of our listeners asked. Somebody is interested in buying the car of that he saw advertised, a neighbor in the neighborhood. So what does he do? He has a few people call up the seller. And when he says the price, you know, I want $6,000 from the car, so they, what, $6,000 for that car? You're never going to get that. I'm sorry, I'm not interested. Sorry, goodbye. You know, after you do this two or three times, the seller gets intimidated. So then finally, when the real buyer steps up and he says, you know, I'll buy it for $4,500, the guy's already thinking, boy, I've gotten trashed by so many assumed purchases, I'll grab the $4,500, and he really doesn't know that this is a setup. So the question is, are you allowed to do this? And are the people who are calling, are they doing is the buyer doing something wrong, and are the people who are assisting him doing something wrong? What would you say to that?
It's an interesting question. It's a fascinating question. It also brings up a variety of different topics. Let's try to address different things in a orderly fashion. With your permission, Rav David, I'd be magdim even something that has to do with the parsha, because I think it's very apropos to the specific question that you asked. The Torah calls in this week's parsha the Seder Hanachla, Dina Yerusha. The Torah gives their name Lechukas Mishpat. The Torah calls the Dinim of Yerusha a Choik and a Mishpat. In the simple context, Choik and Mishpat are contradictory terms. Choik is something we don't understand. Mishpat is something that we do understand, something that makes sense. Choik is something that's beyond our ken, beyond our understanding. So Rav Hirsch says something very fascinating, which I think is very, very appropriate to this type of question. And he says that choik and mishpat doesn't mean specifically something we do understand, something we don't understand. Choik comes from the word chokuk. Chokuk means something that's fixed, something that's kavua. There are certain dinim in Torah that are fixed. They always assume the same form. Basar b'chalav is always basar b'chalav. Of course, you might have a shadow that's contemporary. A kitchen, a modern-day factory in Wisconsin. The practicality might be different, but the facts on the ground of what basar b'chalav is always the same thing. Mishpat, the word shifua, is something that's subjective. And a chosh mishpat, there's many situations where there are fixed dinim. There are certain dinim that are fixed, that are no-nos without any, you know, give or take. A gzela is a gzela, but there's a lot of chesh and mishpat which is subjective and relative to the situation. With that in mind, I'd like to answer the question, understanding that, you know, if we get into a discussion about dinim de machusa, dinim, this type of thing, let's say you're talking about, let's say, with a car, you know, making a fixed bid on something in order to jack up the price for the potential customer, very often I think the place where that comes up very specifically is, let's say, on eBay sales. where somebody bids in order to artificially hike up the asking price. Somebody else could put a, you know, somebody else will feel forced to put a bid that's a bit higher.
Well, that's, that would sort of be the, that would be, that would be the opposite of this case, but it's the same thing, whether to jack up the price
right.
like you would do on eBay,
right, that,
or alternatively to lower the price.
Right, exactly. The idea is how much can you affect somebody else's state of mind when he agrees to a price. How much of that is manipulation? And manipulation is not a clear halachic concept. Gezel is, and that's why I'm pointing out this concept lechukas mishpat. Not everything that's gezel is straightforward. How much is manipulation of a market, a manipulation of somebody else's willingness to go the extra mile and how much he's willing to pay for something, how much of that assumes form of gezel? How much of that is plain, you know, just plain old unethical without necessarily being gezel? How much of dina d'malchusa dina will affect that? Let's try to break that down. If, you know, the question is a question that was discussed, I guess, in different contexts 300-400 years ago. The Chidor, interestingly enough, had a fascinating question. In Tshuvas Chaim Sha'al, it's also in Tshuvas Yosef Eimetz, if I remember correctly, Simon Nun Zayin, where there's a discussion over there about a shul wanted to sell Matiyah. I'm sorry?
Yeah, Elias and Shul. Yeah.
Elias and Shul, they wanted to sell Matiyah for $15,000. They had somebody bid $10,000 in order to start the auctioning at a higher price. Obviously, the understanding was with him, he didn't want to take it if it was $10,000. The Gaboy made up with him that if nobody else would, you know, would bid above him, so he, instead of 10, under the table, he'd be able to only pay 5. They figured that the risk was worth it. Lemaisa, the Maskon of the Chidor, he discusses it back and forth. Again, it's not clear, Gezel. What you're doing is you're creating a scenario where somebody is willing to pay something based on false information, false nitunim, false statistics, or false gemiras das. He answers in that specific case. On the other hand, we have another case where there's a famous Taz in the end of Shimon Lamed Beis in Choshen Mishpat, where the Taz says clearly that if somebody hires a worker for $5 an hour, and he told him that the reason why he's hiring him for $5 an hour is because that's what he has somebody else for. The person really wanted a better wage, he hired him for less, or the other way around. If the worker said he's only willing to pay for 5, he's only willing to work for 5, the boss only wanted to pay 4. He said, I have a job waiting elsewhere for me. That's basically the equivalent of your Shiloh. And over there, the Taz says, everybody does it, Maisim B'chol Yoim, which obviously is not a blanket heter for anything in Choshen Mishpat, Maisim B'chol Yoim. There are many things that are unfortunately Maisim B'chol Yoim that won't pass inspection, but here the Taz felt that the Maisim B'chol Yoim will define in context, and again, in that Mishpat, in the relative speaking, a contextual, what's okay, that's cool that you're not fooling the person to a price. That's just a way of presenting your side. Everybody understands that you could be more forceful in your position, you could be less forceful, and that would be fine. That's what the Taz says. There's a Chavis Yoyim in Pisket Tshuva in Choshen Mishpat Reish Zayin that argues on the Taz. The question is whether that would be the same thing as our case. It's possible. That's only in the context where everybody does it. Maybe a bid where it's somewhat more unusual. Maybe not. Would you say maybe that, let's say, on eBay where the bids are fixed because they're entered in the computer, not something that's going on between two people. The market back and forth between two people, let's say, you know, if you get into a taxi in Eretz Yisrael, where the minig hamokim is to argue with the driver. And you say, I just got the same taxi ride, that same thing I took yesterday at the similar time of the day for 35 shekels. You want 40, I'm only willing to pay 35. And it's really not true. And then he's maskim to 35. Is that manipulation? Is that call he's maskim to go down in price because of false information? That's questionable.
Rabbi Greenwald, first of all, why wouldn't that be Midvar Sheker Tirchak to start with? Okay? And
correct. Correct. You're 1,000% correct. There is no Hetem Midvar Sheker Tirchak. I'm dealing with the Choshen Mishpat, where Choshen Mishpat is dealing with Gezel. You're right. In terms of Isurim, of Isurim Dibur, there might very well be other issues involved.
What about Oinaz Dvarim? You know, Vaisainu Isha Samisai, right, that we say it talks about it. So let's say there's a Meiri in Bab Metzia that says Beferish, he says, this is a Lashon of Meiri, Asa Lahaines is Chaveroi Veligrim Loi Pseidza Bidzvarav. You can't cause your friend loss with words. And he says, this is also the concept of Lysainu Isha Samisai, which is a concept of Aina. So would you say that's a Chayshe Mishpa Shaila or more like a Yeridea Shaila?
It's a fascinating question. What's interesting is that the Shulchan Aruch in Chayshe Mishpa, actually in the Halachos of Aina and Reish Chav Zayin, brings down Aina's Dvarim in what we would call more of a Midas concept of just saying hurtful things to somebody else in the context of Chayshe Mishpa. It would seem that there is quite a Tzad HaShav between the two of them. Aina's Dvarim actually is not every time you play hardball with a potential business partner. It's only where you manipulate something where the price that's actually discussed is not the real price. Now, could we say exactly what the real price of something is? Of course, there's a disparity between there's the upper end of what something is worth, there's the lower end. The back and forth manipulation between two people, if we're talking about something that's within reasonable market range, is okay. That would not fit under the heading of an Ozvar. What could be a problem is, again, the false pretense that we're talking about. If he's masking to pay a certain amount because of information that you gave him, that you have another job or you have another buyer or there's another bidder, something more like that, that would be what would be called a mekachtos, and that's a more serious issue. That's an Ozvar is more of an isakal because it's subjective to taking advantage. Gezel, where I sell something to somebody something, and of course, let's say if I sell somebody a car and there's something wrong with the motor and he doesn't know it, that's flat-out gezel. That's mekachtos. The same is true if he's masking to buy the car under false pretenses. The question will be whether that would be considered creating a false pretense for establishing the basis of the sale.
And what would be your psak if I were to ask you this? So I'm an eBay guy. I'm an eBay seller and I have 10 friends bidding up my thing, looking for somebody to jump at the highest price. Somebody says, Rav Greenwald, I make my business on eBay. Can I or can't I do that?
The pashtus is that it's hard to ask them. It's hard to mean that there's no clear... I'll even share with you a
practice. What about Geneva's Das? Why wouldn't it be Geneva's Das?
Geneva's Das is when you misrepresent the chefetz itself. Geneva's Das in Shulchan Aruch, in Reish Chof Ches, in Reish Lamed Beis, is where you pump up the item itself. There's a misrepresentation of the chefetz. Misha, what would be an example of that? We're talking about eBay. What happens, let's say, you write a false rating of something, where now something that was a 3-star restaurant, hotel, whatever whatever it may be, and you write a rating which will have it go up to a 4-star rating. That will be clear at Geneva's Das.
To put more pressure
on a buyer, with your responsibility, I'll just share with the listeners that I do have a psak from one of my Rebbeim, Reb Naftali Nussbaum Shlita. Reb Naftali Nussbaum is one of the leading Dayanim in Eretz Yisrael that I've done years of shimush by. He has published, I've seen the psak and I've discussed it with him, where you're allowed to pay, let's say he was talking about real estate, wasn't talking about eBay, where you're allowed to pay somebody not to place a bid. Somebody wants to pay $400,000 for a house. You want the house for $375,000. You pay somebody $10,000, go bid on a different house where the fellow doesn't mind. Maybe it wasn't his lechatchila. He feels that that's mutter.
That's not a riot to what I'm saying.
What you're doing is you're getting rid of him.
Yeah,
that's right. There's no
Gnevis
Das. I just wanted to, share that talk with the listeners. Now I want to address.
Well, if somebody has an Airbnb or they have a hotel on TripAdvisor and they pay people to give false ratings, either on Airbnb or TripAdvisor, that according to you, that would be affirmatively us or alternative.
I think that's classic Gnevis Das, yeah.
A pleasure to have you on with us. All the way from Eretz Yisrael, and the Torah of Eretz Yisrael is emanating over the airwaves. We thank you very much, and we hope to have you on again at a later time.
Well, it was a pleasure, and mirtz Hashem, eit chazayim.
Bye-bye.
Thank you, Reb David.
Thank you for joining us. next week we have a really interesting show, and it's going to be a little bit controversial. It's listener discretion advised. If you have sensitive person or if you're younger person, you should not be listening. We will be discussing open orthodoxy. Is it really orthodox? And we will have the president, right? The head of Yeshivas Chovevei Torah, the one that is the sort of president of open orthodoxy. We will be doing an interview with him. We will also be having a counter from two very well-known rabbanim in this field. I was a little trepidatious about doing this because it's sort of opening up something that, you know, the Novominsk Rebbe felt is really blasphemous, is kfira, but he gave me permission to do it, and I got permission from Reb David Cohen as well. So I'm sending in the tale of Ishtali Rav Ravi of Great Giants, but it will be a fascinating show. But again, listener discretion advised. I look forward to speaking to you again next week. This is David Lichtenstein for Headlines Radio. Yeah.